Hello, my name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters, the museum's podcast. Today, my guest is Matthew Gibbs, the General Manager of Media and Communication at the Australian Securities Exchange. And for more than a decade, Matthew also served as the President of the Friends of the Nicholson Museum, now the Friends of the Nicholson Collection. Welcome, Matthew. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my great pleasure, Craig. Thank you. It's nice to come back as a civilian.
Yes,
now,
yes. Because your 11-year presidency ended only a month ago.
That's right. The reign of Gibbs is over. That's why the people were gathered in the streets celebrating.
So we're expecting a presidential library soon then, aren't we?
Let's hope so.
Now, let's kick off. Can you speak a little bit about your career and your interests?
Absolutely. Well, my career, as the title of my role suggests, is in finance, but always with a media or communications, I should say, more than media even background. I was at this university studying economics and law and came back and did some postgraduate work in public affairs. But I've always had an interest in the museums here in particular. Mm. I'm now into my, don't tell anyone, but sixth decade.
It's all right, no one's listening.
Good. And I've been coming to the university museums before the construction, of course, of the Chow Chak Wing for the last five of those six decades. Even as a student, when I was here, when I should have been in the Fisher Stack reading up torts or contract law, I'd hide myself at the back of the Nicholson Museum and marvel at the collection there. I'd also disappear down to the Maclay. Despite being president of the Friends of the Nicholson, I also have a great interest in natural history. So the Maclay Museum was also a great nourishing place for me to come when I was a student here at the university, but even before that, and certainly since. I'm a great believer in the best experiences you can have at university are often once you graduate and finish. You don't need to be a student anymore.
Yes.
Not only are these places great for lifelong learning, I think they're great for lifelong lingering.
And I've
certainly been a lingerer here at the university well beyond my last class.
Yes. I guess my next question then is, how did you go from being a regular museum visitor, both as a student and then as a graduate, to becoming involved with the Friends of the Nicholson Museum as it was back in the day?
I guess the director or the curator at the time, Michael Turner, just thought, I can't keep stepping over this bloke. He's in here. He's in here all the time. I should find something useful for him to do. And he invited me then to nominate to serve on council. I was fortunate enough to be elected. And then that was in 2006. And then in 2010, in their infinite wisdom, members of the Friends elected me president. So I think it's probably interesting that if perhaps the Maclay Museum had have had a Friends organisation, I may have become
president of
the Friends of the Maclay rather than the Nicholson, or maybe a sort of an omnipresident
over
multiple museums, given my interest.
Yeah.
although that would offend all sorts of governance and good practice arrangements. So it was probably that. Just becoming very familiar with the museums, being a regular attendee and lover of them and taking part in events, and then just saying, look, what else can I do?
Yeah.
How else can I be involved as a supporter of the work that the museums were doing? And that's probably how it first happened.
I'm going to ask you a bit about what you achieved during that decade, but before I do, can you tell our listeners what is the Friends of the Nicholson Museum, as it has been historically, but of course now the Friends of the Nicholson Collection? And more importantly, why should they join up? Why should they sign up?
Well, the official purpose, if you like, of the Friends of the Nicholson Collection, as you say, as it now is called, it's dedicated to the improving presentation and conservation of the collection. One of the wonderful things now about joining the Friends of the Nicholson Collection is, in effect, you get fast-tracked as a friend, unofficially at this stage anyway, of the whole Chow Chak Wing Museum Collection.
Indeed.
So there are 30,000 or so objects under the Nicholson banner there'd be that
450,000 in total.
There we are, more than 10 times. That's value for money, in my view. I think it's still
this
a
is
mere
the finance expert speaking. Now,
well,
isn't it?
No. It's still a mere $70 for an individual membership. And with that comes the usual array of benefits, discounts here, discounts there. Interestingly, though, over the past 12 months or so, as we've endured the pandemic and social distancing and lockdown, etc., and while the Nicholson and the other museums were closed prior to the opening of the Chow Chak Wing, membership of the Friends of the Nicholson Collection did not drop. Clearly, there were few benefits. You couldn't come to real lectures. You couldn't wander through the collection, but membership stayed constant. And I think that certainly, I would feel this way too, and clearly lots of other friends did, that being a member is not really about, well, what do I get back? There is a genuine love of the artifacts and the artworks and all of the pieces across all of the collections. And perhaps like me all those years ago, whether you vocalise it or not, people are coming in and saying, I want to be part of this. Mm. I'd like to support it. I want to be around it.
It's a sense of belonging, yes, as it is with any club, isn't it?
I think so. And like clubs that endure and club memberships that you continually renew, you get a lot back as well.
Yeah. So, of course, the Friends of the Nicholson Museum, as it was originally, actually has quite a long history, doesn't it? It dates back to 1945, founded by Professor Trendall when he was curator, and has been quite instrumental in the acquisition of a number of objects within
Indeed.
The Nicholson collection.
But indeed.
Obviously, the nature of museum collecting has changed considerably since the post-World War II period, but what are some of the highlights from your decade of involvement with the Friends?
Well, just before that, you make a good point about being a member, and that is that one of the things that members do that is very valuable is that the money they spend on membership, the money they spend in the shop, the money they might spend attending events, in part does go towards funds to acquire new objects. At least that's how it was at the Nicholson. I'm sure something like that will continue at the Chow Chak. And there is something very special if you're a member of the Friends and you've contributed financially. And I'm not talking, these aren't the millions of dollars.
No,
that
this is just the annual membership
that's
fee,
right,
isn't it?
It's just ordinary members contributing their little amounts. But collectively it adds up to a lot. And when purchases were made, and then they were put on display, and there was a great pride among the members to see, well, that pot or that sword or that whatever it might be was acquired with the help of the Friends.
Yeah.
And that, again, goes to this great sense of being part of something very important. And as you were saying, part of something that has a long history. You know, the Nicholson Museum or the collection itself stretches way back before 1945, of course, and then the Friends were officially formed then, and I'm sure under the new management at the Chow Chak, the Friends organisation will change and flourish and be enhanced again. So I think that they're all very critical parts of being a friend and why you want this association.
We've certainly got big ambitions for the Friends organisation going forward. I mean, no museum can really operate without a supporters group of some sort.
Yeah.
So.
I didn't even answer your question. You asked about some of the highlights. I think, in a sense, one of the highlights is why we're here, or the fact that we are here. And I don't mean you're interviewing me. Mm. I mean, I'm at one. But the fact that now there is the Chow Chak Wing Museum, that podcasts like this are being produced and made available, and you were saying earlier that you're very happy with the listening audience so far, and that's only going to get bigger. I think that one of the main highlights for me being involved with the Nicholson for so long was that through the work of a number of curators, executives like yourself, the support that the university proper gave it, it really did turbocharge awareness about the museums on campus. And the Nicholson, I remember as an undergraduate here, it wasn't well known. It didn't have a high profile, even on campus.
That's true, yes.
And unless you were lost, you didn't wander in, unless except if your tutor or lecturer said, you've got to go there and have a look at this particular specimen or object. But as I say, over successive years, it has been transformed and really was the springboard, I think, its success at attracting a wider audience, not just Friends members, but other people interested in the arts and culture and museum attendance would come to events. And so the awareness of the Nicholson increased, and that then increased awareness of the wonderful things on campus and transformed the notion of the university museums into museums universal, into museums, into places where that are available and can be visited by the people of Sydney, by the people of New South Wales.
Yeah.
They are wonderful showcases for Australia and, you know, for international audiences as well. I think that's been the serious highlight.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure working with you, I must say, and I'm pleased that you'll still be around. But I guess, look, this podcast has got object matters, and we've yet to actually speak about an object. So what item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection have you chosen today for us to discuss?
Well, I'm glad you're sitting down, Craig, because you're probably going to expect me to say something from the Nicholson.
Mm.
I've got 30,000
to choose from?
Perhaps that's too much choice. I gave you a little clue earlier when I said that I also had a love affair of sorts with the Maclay because of my interest in natural history. And when the Chow Chak first opened, in the very first exhibition that you encountered as you wandered in through the doors,
object art specimen,
was the item that I've chosen, and that is the thylacine.
Right.
The Thylacinus cynocephalus.
Yes, I'm pleased you said that. It saved me doing it.
Well, and of course, clues in the name. The pouched dog with wolf head. So the Tasmanian tiger, as perhaps it's better known, although more sadly known, because I think even in the name, tiger is one of the reasons it was pursued and persecuted.
Yes.
And for similar reasons, I worry about the Tasmanian devil.
Yeah.
It's got its own issues, of course, with its survival. But what chance do some animals have if they're called tigers or hyenas or wolves or devils? But that's the item I've chosen. It's the thylacine, the taxidermy thylacine. Yes, and I know the Maclay has a number of thylacine specimens.
Yeah, but this is the mounted specimen.
The mounted specimen. And you've told me before that it's on display from time to time and then it needs to be taken down for preservation because it's very fragile.
It's very, very fragile. So it is one of our treasures in the true meaning of the word. Mm. But it is also an object that requires great care and conservation for a large number of reasons. So it's one that's not always on display, and it's a great thrill that it was during the opening exhibition. Currently, visitors will see not it, but instead one of our skeletal specimens.
Right.
But the mounted one will be out in public in future, and we'll talk about that later on as well.
Indeed.
But
and I think you've got the Maclay's also got, well, now the Chow Chak, of course, it's also got some photographic material of thylacines.
Yes, that's my understanding too.
Yeah.
I guess talking quite specifically about the mounted specimen, could you describe it to our listeners?
Well, let me start with a criticism. The eyes are wrong. Taxidermists, and I've seen this with a number of thylacine specimens in museums. And by the way, what a shame that we see it in a museum and not in a zoo.
Well, I want to ask you more about this as we go on.
Okay,
well,
don't get me started. Or even in the wild, of course, would be best. I mean, and just on that, we can almost touch it. You know, the almost certain extinction of the thylacine, certainly in captivity, the last one died in 1936. Our grandparents could have seen them live.
Yes.
That's how close they are.
Yeah.
Dodos died out in the 17th century. Moas in New Zealand a few hundred years before that. Mammoths 10,000 years ago.
Yes.
But the Tasmanian tiger, the thylacine, was as recent as the 1930s and perhaps even in the 1950s in the wild.
It's also a warning to us of, you know, how many other species are on the critically endangered list, literally as we are speaking right now, and we must do everything within our measure.
Australia leads the world in many things, of which we should be proud. One of the areas where we lead the world, alas, is also in rate of extinction of native species. I know that there's a great deal of public and political consciousness of that, so let's hope we arrest that. I'm happy not to be on the podium when it comes to that competition.
Yes, well,
let's run last. But
certainly,
in terms of describing the object, when I say the eyes are wrong, I mean it goes to the uniqueness I think, of the animal, and a wonderful thing it is and was. There is something in the eyes that was unique. Generally, it seems that the taxidermists, as great as their art is, they put in eyes that might suit a dog or a cat or a wolf or something. But the thylacine had, bearing in mind it was a marsupial, it had sharper, narrower, more striking and distinctive eyes. But that aside, the thylacine, most listeners would know, it's the size of a medium-sized dog. Most distinctive are its stripes, and they varied from, in terms of number, up to the early 20s, beginning from its shoulders down its back to the top of its tail. Interesting, the tail. The tail's not like a dog's tail. It's not a tail that wagged. Yep. It's like a kangaroo's tail.
Yeah, yes.
It's stiff and it's strong. There's no evidence that, like kangaroos, they use the tail as an extra leg. But again, that hints at or points to its marsupialness.
But it's interesting. I mean, it's far more reminiscent of a cat's tail than a dog's tail, and I suspect might have also, along with the stripes, contributed to the European misnaming of it being a tiger.
Well, it was called both canine and feline.
Was it?
And then a hyena, which is neither.
Yeah.
So it was called all sorts of things in our ignorance at the time, and that's never a good thing for a creature. If us humans are ignorant of something, we generally fill that vacuum with the wrong stuff. That's right. But this is another fascinating aspect, I think, of the thylacine. So we've just described it. It looks like a dog. It has names like tiger, hyena, wolf, etc. It has a tail that more closely resembles a kangaroo. It has a pouch, of course, like all marsupials. Like the devil, like the wombat, its pouch was backward-facing, rather than the more, we think of kangaroos and wallabies with where the joey sticks its head up and out front. To protect the joeys, of course, and all marsupial babies are joeys, to protect the joeys, the pouch faced the other way it didn't hurt the joeys. The other interesting thing, it's one of the few marsupials where the males have a pouch of sorts as well.
Oh, really?
Not for young, but to protect the male genitals and other organs for similar reasons as it's going through the undergrowth.
I guess any of our listeners who have been bushwalking in Tasmania will know. The wilderness of some of those national parks and so on down in the state of Tasmania, just how thick it is, and you can see why we'll talk about this later on, but you can see why there's the enduring stories of people believing that there are still some wild specimens.
Well, the interesting thing too about the males having the pouch of sorts is it led to some confusion with the last tiger in captivity.
Right, yeah.
It's best known as Benjamin was the name of the last one who died in a zoo in Hobart, 1936, September 1936, which incidentally has become national, I think, endangered species, national threatened species day in Australia.
Yes,
the 7th of September 1936 was when Benjamin died. But for a while, as we were looking at more recently, as experts were looking at the limited footage we have of Benjamin, there was a presumption of perhaps it was Betty or Belinda rather than Benjamin, because the pouch was there protecting what we normally look for to identify it being male.
Do you happen to know what actually happened to that particular...
Well, it's like doubly sad. I mean, didn't the thylacine suffer enough? Benjamin actually died as a result of being left outside his night pen.
Really?
So he died of exposure. Now,
I didn't know that.
It was probably, I don't know how old Benjamin was, and they could live, they lived as most animals tend to, they do live longer in captivity. I think the longest lived was about 14 years. Generally it was 7 to 9 years in captivity, and they were very popular in zoos for a while, internationally, in the United States, in the UK and Australia. But Benjamin actually died officially as a result of exposure. It gets a little cold in Tasmania.
Yes, and then early September, it'll still be winter.
And you can imagine those enclosures for animals in zoos in the 1930s.
Yes, it's not like the modern zoo experience at all, is it?
I remember going to zoos in Sydney as a child. I love them. And the large mammals were in cement holes in the ground, basically. Yeah. So poor Benjamin was left out overnight and was found my understanding is, was found dead the next morning. But there's a wonderful this concept that, and I'm no scientist, just an amateur enthusiast, about, I think they call it convergent evolution, where the thylacine, we've described what it looks like, and people have in their mind what it looks like. It looks like a dog or a wolf, but it clearly is not, and is not like those animals genetically at all.
Yes.
Its closest relatives are the Tasmanian devil and the numbat, and yet these creatures in other parts of the world that never got together have converged as a result of evolution, that nature has worked out that if you're the apex mammal predator on whatever continent you happen to live,
and particularly on an island where you're isolated,
you're going to start to look like that, with that shaped jaw, with that sort of size, with a tail that looks a bit like that, with a sleek body that looks like that.
Yes.
It's remarkable. That there are other features which wolves and other mammals of the kind don't have. It had the Tasmanian tiger, the thylacine, had a, well, could open its jaw about 90 degrees, which was extraordinarily
large. I was going to ask you about the jaw, because, of course, they are such powerful weapons, the jaw, and we have a number of, on display at the moment, a number of skull specimens as well. You know, incredible strength, don't they?
The devil more so, apparently, than the tiger. But nevertheless, its jaw and its ability to open its mouth as wide as it could for sure contributed to the perception that these creatures they're killing our lamb and they're killing our chickens. And they're killing the possums that we want to harvest for their fur. So the thylacine was first encountered by Europeans, and by this stage they're only living in Tasmania in splendid isolation until the arrival of Europeans. The first Europeans, I think, came to Tasmania in 1803, and the last thylacine died in captivity in 1936.
Yes, it's a very, very rapid decline, isn't it? Yes.
And there were various bounties, including, infamously, a government-sponsored bounty. You could bring in the carcass of a thylacine and the government would pay you. You can understand the reasons, even if you can't forgive now, because they were largely misunderstood as being a threat to livestock and the Tasmanian economy at that time.
Based on agriculture.
Absolutely. And the government, of course, was persuaded more to look after its population and its industry than it was its wildlife.
Yeah.
Strangely, though, tragically, there is much more money available now if you can demonstrate evidence of the thylacine being alive than there ever was
at the time.
And over the years, many well-known individuals have put up money or organised expeditions to Tasmania to try and locate them. The Greens, as he became the Green Senator, Bob Brown was part of one in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Walt Disney funded one,
really?
I think, in the 1950s. Ted Turner, the CNN media magnate, he was behind one more recently. The Bulletin magazine, if those...
So it's interesting, is it the international profile as well as the national one? Because I'm going to ask you a little bit later on about the Tasmanian tiger within the Australian psyche, but it's...
Yes.
It is a species with an international reputation, isn't it?
Well, it's become one of those iconic images. And because, as I was saying, the other things that are equally well known as no longer being in existence, they were made extinct a long time ago. The thylacine is so close.
Yeah. Now, and talking about our particular specimen, and by the way, we're talking about dates before too, but of course 1808 was when it was first scientifically classified as well. So, you know, part of that very rapid process of first European encounter, first European scientific recognition of the species, and then that rapid hunting and destroying of habitat.
Yes.
It's really quite rapid. But in terms of the Maclay Collection specimen that we are focusing on today, do you know anything about its backstory as to how it came to us?
Only what's available on the very good website, the Chow Chak Museum. Bear in mind, as president of the Friends of the Nicholson Collection, I would have been hauled before council if I was seen fiddling with any of the Maclay stuff. I had to keep my eyes focused on Nicholson materials.
All one big happy family now.
That's true. But my understanding is it was actually the specimen we're talking about, the taxidermied one, was donated by the Maclay family in the 19th century. So it's been part of the university's collection
for some time.
Some of the skeletal remains that the university museum has, I think, have been acquired more recently.
Yes.
And some of the photographs, again, more recently, according to the website, under the Cultural Gifts Program. And I would urge listeners to really explore the Chow Chak Wing Museum website. It's terrific. And have you got most of the
material on there? Most of the art collection and a very large proportion of the antiquities from the Nicholson collection are up, but much of the natural history collection and photography collection are in the process of being digitised.
Okay.
Certainly our aim is to get as much of the collection as possible.
It's a gigantic task, so I'll be patient. But already it's wonderful. The other wonderful thing about not just specifically the thylacine, but I love coming to the Chow Chak Wing Museum now, and I can find the things that I fell in love with as part of my Nicholson duties, and they're blended in interestingly, insightfully, stimulatingly, are objects from the other collections, from the art gallery collection, from the Maclay. And it was one of the reasons why I was a great supporter of the Chow Chak, the idea of the Chow Chak, not just because more space, bigger gift shop, decent coffee, not just that, although those things are all important now, but because the opportunity it offered to bring different objects from different collections together, and not just under one roof. That's the Maclay room, that's the Nicholson room, but within the one exhibition. And I think one of the great things that the new museum has done is exactly that.
The blending.
The blending in a very stimulating way.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker, and my guest for this episode is Matthew Gibbs. Now, Matthew, I know you're a man of many, many interests and lots of fingers and lots of different pies, but...
I've only got 8 fingers. Well, and 2 thumbs.
But in terms of the Tasmanian tiger, how does it fit into your... You spoke before about visiting the Maclay, but how does the Tasmanian tiger fit into your interests and the things that you're intrigued by?
It's a good question. I don't quite know, other than I know I've always been interested in it. It's like the lion in Africa. It's like the tiger in Asia.
Yeah.
It's like the wolf in Europe. The thylacine was Australia's apex mammal predator, top of the food chain. And all of those other creatures I named are also threatened, endangered, and at risk.
That all of them have lost that position because of human activities.
You're right. In fact, there is one apex mammal predator above all of them, and you and I are
That's
part
us.
Of that.
Yes.
But so I've always been interested in those things, those apex. I don't just mean carnivores. I'm fascinated by what happens to be at the top of chains.
But there was also, by the way, does this fit into your job in terms of the cutthroat world of international finance? Is there any parallel there, or am I stretching the bow a little far?
Well, as you know, and as friends of the Nicholson collection know, I do tend to throw in a little bit of Shakespeare or poetry every now and then.
I'm going to be asking you this later on.
So I would certainly concede that my interest in Shakespeare in particular has been very handy, and I apply it as much as I can in my corporate life. And indeed, I argue that it's been a value add for me. That yes, I did some of the traditional things, some of the expected things for someone like me who works... In the height of industry. But my background in Shakespeare in particular, and for many years I had a theatre and education program called A Bit of Bard, which I'd take around to high schools in New South Wales. And in my youth, I had dreams of being Australia's Laurence Olivier or Richard Burton or Peter O'Toole. And then there was a bloke called John Bell here. And I have the greatest respect for John. So he did all of that.
Yes.
I worked out I was never going to be that. I was never going to be an actor of that quality. But I did think I could pursue my interest in Shakespeare. I worked out that's really what I'm interested in, Shakespeare, not so much acting. And so I have continued to learn from and apply Shakespeare in my corporate work. And I don't just mean coming up with interesting speeches or articles like Shakespeare in the Stock Market or poetry and price earnings ratios. I do think there are lessons about leadership, about humility, about transparency, about friendship.
The wonder of the world around us.
Yes, about reputation. There are lots of lessons from Shakespeare and other disciplines too, of course, that can be and should be applied to now.
Yeah.
I love the fact that Shakespeare's still all around us. And generally, most of us aren't aware of it.
Yes.
Again, one of my other dirty habits is I clip from newspapers headlines.
Very old school.
That's right. It drives my family mad because they know I've been in the house because there are these little newsprint fingerprints all around the place because I still get the printed copy. But in any event, I collect headlines from news articles that feature a Shakespearean expression. And there are still dozens a day. So, yes, I haven't yet worked out how I've slipped the thylacine into an annual report for the ASX. but I can certainly use my passion for Shakespeare and put it to good use. And as I said earlier, I think that's a value add for me. It certainly makes me different. But I think it actually adds value. And I need it. Frankly, I need it as part of my working life. It's part of who I am, and it's something that I can bring to work every day, and it's part of what I like about my work.
One wonders how Shakespeare would have described Australian mammals, marsupials.
You're right. Well, as we know about Shakespeare, he was able to when he saw or came across the unusual, he was able to put it in words better than anyone else. And often he invented words
to make it work.
That's right. Yeah. So let's presume that he would have come up with words. He would have invented the right words to fit the uniqueness of our fauna,
yes,
if he had spotted it.
Rather than describing it as it looks like a tiger.
That's right. Yeah. But I mean, I think, and I know we've been talking about this earlier, that if not Shakespeare, who of course didn't have the opportunity to see the thylacine. Now, someone else who probably didn't see the thylacine either, but did write a nice poem, which I think reflects the thylacine. And I'm talking, of course, about William Blake and his much-anthologised poem, The Tiger, which I understand is one of the most anthologised poems in the language. So let me pretend that he saw thylacine. Yeah. I know the dates don't match, but let's pretend. And he wrote about it. I think it's a very healthy thing, anyway, that we bring as much of ourself to the various parts of our lives, and they bring a balance.
Very good observation.
You know, again, don't tell anyone I said this, but, you know, I'll say to colleagues at work, it doesn't matter, it's only work. Now, I don't really mean it. Of course work matters for all sorts of reasons. But what I mean is there's more than just work.
Yes.
And that ability to have, you know, context and perspective and other thing in your life is important.
That's one of the roles of a museum and a gallery, isn't it? Is to let us reflect who we are in the bigger picture.
What does museum mean? Doesn't it in part mean to contemplate, a place to contemplate?
Yeah, and a reference to the ancient muses, of course.
Yes,
too.
So a place to contemplate the muses. We all need spaces to contemplate. And the wonderful thing about the Chow Chak Wing is there's so much space to contemplate.
And so much of a collection to contemplate.
Muses everywhere you look. Muses everywhere you look.
Anyway, Blake.
Blake, you'd like some.
If you're up for it.
Well, I think the best bit, the most relevant bit, the bit that we can share is the opening stanza. Tiger, tiger burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? Not only is that relevant for a discussion about the Tasmanian tiger, but it captures some of the things we're saying, and frankly some of the things that brought the poor old thylacine down. This, can it be so? Can, let's get religious or spiritual for a moment, can a god that created the lamb, and this poem, by the way, was a compliment or a companion to Blake's The Lamb, can whoever created a lamb create a tiger as well? Such heaven and hell, such beauty and ferocity, such meekness, such gentleness, such power. That's what Blake is asking. And he concludes, well, of course.
Yeah.
That's almost the paradox, the contrariness of our humanity and of nature. And there's beauty in all things. And if only we had have recognised the beauty of the thylacine, its uniqueness, its role, it would still be around.
Yeah.
And let's for a moment, Craig, let's for a moment pretend it is. It is still out there. Yeah. We just haven't found it's cleverer than us.
Well, there are, of course, many people who believe. There are a few still
in the
wilderness.
There are regular sightings. Mm. It's just that most of them are on the mainland, which is a little worrying. But there are still regular sightings. Just a month or so ago, there was an international story created. A gentleman from Tasmania released some photographs purporting to be of a thylacine or thylacine. Experts examined them and dismissed them as probably not, i.e. definitely not thylacines. They were paddy melons or a wallaby of some sort. But the hunt still goes on, and hunt's not the right word, definitely not. The search still goes on. The hope still lives. The dream shall never die. I think the reality, sadly, is that it's estimated that when Europeans arrived in Tasmania at the beginning of the 19th century, there were probably 4,000 to 5,000 thylacines only. The government bounty alone paid out for about 2,200 thylacines.
That's halving the population immediately.
The last one in captivity died 1936. They believe that it's likely that they could have survived in the wild for another decade or so. But in the absence of real evidence since then, because they were officially declared extinct, I think, in the 1980s, the absence of evidence, and given that wherever they are, if they are still alive, they'd be in a small, tiny pocket. The gene pool would be too small to sustain a healthy, viable population. My heart hopes, but my head says, no, they're gone.
Well, I often think that many of those sightings, and this includes things like Nessie and so on as well too, the more fantastic sightings, but it's often a collective subconscious desire for there to be more to the world than there is as well. I sometimes wonder whether we're projecting our desires for it to still be alive onto a rustle in the bushes. It must be a Tasmanian tiger.
And I agree with you. And what a wonderful thing that is.
I think that human imagination can still be active.
But too late sometimes. That's the tragedy. That's the lesson we've got to learn, that we don't want to be in a position where it is only hope and wishing and hoping.
That rustle in the bush might be the recently extinct koala or whatever.
You make a good point. And isn't it interesting, thank goodness, isn't it interesting how differently we now react to the possibility of something like the koala or the Tasmanian devil? And it has its issues with this face
cancer. Which, of course, the University of Sydney has been quite heavily involved in some research into that as well.
I didn't know that. Well, very, very good. Another reason to be a proud alumnus of this institution. But I suspect thylacine is no longer with us. But at least you can see it in places like the Chow Chak Wing.
That's true.
A variation thereon.
Yeah. Whilst, obviously, it is the thylacine is extinct, it lives on in Australian popular culture.
Indeed.
We do see the Tasmanian tiger pop up in all sorts of places. Why do you think it's so ingrained in our popular culture? Well, do you think its extinction has actually become part of the reason why we value it?
Part of me thinks we should be ashamed of ourselves.
Well, it should be, but...
And here we are, wrapping ourselves in Tasmanian tigers. When we being recent Australians, we very much contributed to its extinction. It's a good question. Going through my... Because I don't throw things out, Craig.
Yes.
Going through my little bits and pieces, and I didn't know this until I was just putting together some thoughts for this chat today, that the Maclay Museum used to, its brochureware.
In our logo of the 1990s, early 2000s.
Yes.
Yes.
There he is. There's the thylacine. So it was important and distinctive enough for the Maclay Museum, who of course has the specimens, but to use that amid all its other wonderful treasures, it used the thylacine as its symbol. It's on the Tasmanian coat of arms, which is a bit cheeky, I think. It's the Tasmanian cricket teams, both the male and female state teams, are called the Tigers.
Oh, are they?
It's the symbol of one of Tasmania's best known beers, the Cascade brand.
Yes.
It's funny. I'm not a beer drinker. The only beer I'll buy for friends and guests and family
is Cascade,
because I just like opening my fridge from time to time
and
reaching for the wine, but seeing a thylacine look back at me. I have a modest little collection of thylacine artworks and coins and other things. Yes, other things. And there are a few dealers in Sydney and interstate that keep me supplied with antique prints and other things. So it's certainly a creature, no doubt, because of its unique appearance, and now more lately its disappearance, that has fascinated artists and the public as well.
Yeah.
So that's probably why it remains such a strong, identifiable symbol.
It's an instantly recognisable animal species that, you know, even though we haven't seen one living for, you know, coming up to a century, you know, it's instantly recognisable. School students will know what it is, whereas a numbat or, you know, a number of other Australian specimens that have survived and are doing okay just don't have that same iconic appeal.
And it's ours. It's ours as well. But it is, there's something about being at the top of things. You know, the red kangaroo is better known than the, you know, the hopping mouse,
yes,
for example.
Yes.
The wedge-tail eagle is better known than the little eagle. There's something about the apex of things, or being at the apex. And so, as I mentioned earlier, the thylacine's our equivalent of the lion or the tiger. So it is big, it is distinctive, it is recognisable, and it is / was ours uniquely. And Even in its extinction, there's something still to hold on to there, to embrace about that. And if nothing else, it can act as a
It's a warning bell for us, isn't it?
Let's ensure that does not happen again.
So the Maclay Mountain specimen, each time you see it, what do you, or how do you find yourself responding to it?
I don't want to sound trite or melodramatic. This is a serious program. But I'm moved by it. I am. Because there is, I find there is a sadness that it isn't, that's as close as we'll get
to
looking at something stuffed with glass between us.
Yeah.
There's a sadness about that. Including because of then what it was in the wild, its place in the scheme of things too. Now that's not to say that a little beetle is not more deserving of a large mammal, they are equally so. But to lose something like the thylacine, I think, is especially sad. So I look at it, I'm struck by a sadness, but then as I move around the specimen, I see there's a beauty about it as well, and this is in Blake's poem, "What immortal hand, you know, could frame the symmetry?"
It must have been majestic to have seen one move through the wild, because you can just get a sense of it darting in and out
and camouflaged with those stripes. Even when it was relatively abundant, it was rarely seen. So it was, unlike a wolf, for example, it didn't hunt in packs, didn't live in large.
Yeah, they were very solitary, weren't they?
They were, and their method of hunting, they didn't run things down. They didn't have cheetah-like speed. They weren't like the devil, for example, which tends to be a scavenger.
Yeah.
They'd either lie in wait, so a stealth hunter, or they would exhaust their prey. So even in that, there's something distinctive, interesting, unique, perhaps, about the way they went about their own life, which I find appealing, and again adds up to this. There is nothing else like it, and so I, as I say, I have mixed feelings when I see it, and yet every time I come into the museum, I want to see it. I'm compelled to see it, and every time I do see it, I see something different. There's something extra. Ah, didn't see that, or look at the shape of the ears, or the tail. Yes, I can see how the tail was used and why. If you're running through the undergrowth, you don't want a tail that's sort of swinging from side to side. You know,
collecting spurs and branches. And
so I never tire of looking at it or looking at images of it that I have. It was a close-run thing, I must say, to choose this particular, because there are lots of things in the collection that I love looking at, not just for their own sake, the beauty that they themselves have, but for the stories that they tell as well.
Yes.
I may have devoted 2 minutes to describing the particular specimen of thylacine you have, but we've spent many minutes talking about the stories around them. And similarly, I find there's so much in the collection, so many objects and artifacts that you're drawn to because of what they are, their shape, their colour, their size. But then you keep coming back to them because of the stories they tell, or the stories that surround them.
And what we're inviting our listeners and our visitors to the museum to do is to discover their own stories as well, to bring their stories to us, part of the search for the the search for the Philocene, search for your own Philocene.
And that's what it's about, I think.
It's part of a broader change in museology as well, too, because, of course, at the time of the 19th century where Philocene specimens were being collected by people like the Maclays, and even in the 1930s when Benjamin was drawing its breath, you had a very 19th and 20th century concept of a museum being the voice of authority. And, of course, what we are now realising is that museums should be voices for everybody, and particularly for communities of various types to tell their stories. But one of the interesting things is not what the expert knows about the Philocene, but it's also about what we, the visitors, and we, the people who are experiencing the specimen of the Philocene, can bring to it as well, too. So we really want that message that the Chow Chek Wing Museum collection and all museums should be for everybody.
Well, indeed. And I challenge every visitor that walks through the door who's come in for a particular reason, to see a particular thing, I challenge them to leave having only seen that one thing,
yes,
maintaining an exclusive interest,
yes,
in that particular,
yes,
object that drew them there in the first place. It's the serendipity of the other things you stumble across. And again, one of the strengths of a museum like the Chow Chak is that now your opportunity to stumble across things that you didn't even know were part of the collection.
Indeed.
It's just enhanced,
indeed,
you know, so many fold. I think in my very first speech as president of the Nicholson Friends all those years ago, I quoted what Howard Carter, the Egyptologist, said when he broke into King Tut's,
yes,
tomb. And the others behind him said, "What do you see? What do you see?" And he said, "Wondrous things." And it's a bit like as those doors slide open on the Chow Chak, you're walking into a King Tut-like space full of wondrous things. The things that you may expect to see, but lots of other treasures you had no idea existed. And there they are.
Thank you, Matthew. Now, one thing I'm asking everyone who appears on the podcast is to find a single word. If you only had one word, what does this object, so the Philocene specimen in this case, what does it signify for you?
As is evident, I struggle
you
with
like
single
words.
How about I be different and I say, what about two words that at least start with the one letter?
I'll buy that.
And we've covered the topic already, I must say. And those two words starting with W are wonder and warning.
Mm.
The wonder of the creature, what it was, how it evolved, its role in our landscape, and then the warning of, let's make sure that its fate is not the fate of the other wonderful creatures.
And indeed our own fate.
And our, yes. When I'm doing the podcast and asking the questions in decades to come, will we people be, that's the taxidermied Craig Barker on display. You mean in that sense, do you? The warning about our own
and
survival.
Humans are, the 21st century will be a very important one for humans on this planet. And we need to learn from our mistakes. And the Philocene is, as you say, a warning, isn't it?
Well, yes. In that sense, the warning is not just the power of us to do damage to other creatures, but it's the power of us to do damage to our own,
yes,
species and to the planet.
Yeah.
And I know we're getting all
philosophical.
David Attenborough here, one of my, not heroes, but certainly one of the people I most admire. So, yes, wonder and warning are the two words that come immediately to mind when I look at the object of the Philocene.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew. That's a brilliant place to end. And what a journey this has been. We've gone from your experiences in the museum as a student to Tasmania to beer to cricket teams to philosophical questions about our state of being to poetry. I'm so pleased that although your official role as president of the Friends has ended, that you're still going to be a big part of the Chow Chak Wing Museum story. You are, of course, famous for ending all of your speeches when you were president for various events and functions at the museum with a Shakespearean quote. Would you like to end with a word from WS now?
Dear, oh dear, I've
put you on the spot a little bit, haven't I?
You have put me on the spot. But perhaps it's things that seem disconnected to our modern life can still play a very important and enriching role. And I spoke about Shakespeare and how I try and apply that and use that and learn from Shakespeare to my work in finance and communications. And one of my favourite parts of Shakespeare, which is so critical to all of us, but to business in particular, is about good name is about reputation. That matters so much to all of us, of course. You know, without it, we're not much. But with it, we can be so much. And there's some words from Othello, ironically spoken by the least trustworthy character in the play, Iago, who highlights the value of the good name when he says, "Good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse? Steals trash. 'Tis something, nothing. 'Twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him, but makes me poor indeed."
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Matthew Gibbs, this has been Object Matters. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney acknowledges the traditional owners of these grounds, and we pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.